Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week. So come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe
and watch for deer.
Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey y'all, I'm your host Mark Covey.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is Mountain State Mysteries. The case we have for you today is about a couple that went out for a late night drive. No one knows where they were going, only that it ended up in a fiery blaze near Wolf Creek, Virginia. More than 48 years later, there's still no answers. This is the case of Karen Lynn Noble and Jeffrey Lee Scott. Jeff Scott and Karen Noble were born within a year of one another. Jeff in 1957 and Karen in 1958. Both grew up in southern West Virginia. Jeff is described as being a natural photographer who loved playing basketball and would go out of his way to help anyone. Karen was on the dean's student list. She loved cheerleading and playing the dulcimer. According to her friends, she was always happy. She was the kind of person who just make you want to smile. Jeff graduated from Bramwell High School in 1975. Karen graduated from Bluefield High School in 1976. In May of 1978, they were attending Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia.
Cute.
It really is.
So, did they ever say what they were majoring in?
Karen was geology and Jeff was in accounting.
And how long were they dating?
For around 4 years. Those who knew them said they were very much in love and enjoyed their relationship. The two returned home in May of 1978, both looking forward to their summer vacation. At some point on the night of May 28th, 1978, something went wrong and the lives of the couple were cut short. Sunday, May 28th, 1978, the second of their three-day weekend, Jeff spent part of his Sunday jogging and playing basketball with friends. Karen was returning home with her parents from a nine-day family trip to Kansas. According to her parents, Jeff showed up at their Bluefield, West Virginia home around 8:45 p.m. Not too long after he arrived, the two drove out for a late-night date.
Did her parents know where they were going?
Sadly, no. Apparently, no one knew exactly where they were planning to go. In 1978, Karen lived on Parkwood Street in Bluefield, West Virginia. Her parents later said that the couple drove away from the home at 8:50 p.m. Just as the sun was starting to set, her parents assumed that the couple were headed for Route 61 in Virginia. It's your typical country road that parallels Wolf Creek. The couple were known to travel the area a lot.
I get having a favorite area to travel to, right. But why that particular area?
They reportedly had a peaked interest in log homes and cabins, which I guess was all over that area.
Is the exact route known that they took?
The exact one isn't really known. They do think that they left Karen's home in Bluefield, driving east on Route 46 and 52, continued along the Cumberland Road, turned on and proceeded south on Interstate 77, crossed in Virginia by going through the East River Mountain Tunnel, then turned east on Route 61.
So in reality, wasn't a very long trip.
No, it would have been like a 15-minute drive depending on the traffic and stoplights. So the area they went to is honestly very desolate. I mean, it goes from Blaine County, Virginia to Giles County, Virginia, and ends in the town of Narrows. The area is populated by small homes, cabins, and farmhouses. I mean, this is one of the areas that you go to that really hasn't changed much over the years. I mean, even today, the road is lightly traveled.
Did anybody know if they were seen in the area?
They actually were. At 9:15 p.m., according to Mr. Robert Louder, a Bluefield resident who was actually staying in his Blaine County cabin, he said that he saw Jeff's blue 1977 Datsun pickup truck pull off Route 61 to a picnic table located on the property just to the east. He said that he saw a young man and woman fitting the description of Karen and Jeff. He said he saw them get out of the vehicle and proceed on foot through a wooded area and towards Wolf Creek. He said that the pickup truck had a West Virginia license plate on it.
So at this given point, we don't have a clue what they were doing.
No.
But I'm sure we can guess.
And I'm sure you wouldn't be wrong with your guessing. Louder said 1 hour after he first saw them between 10 or 10:15 p.m., he said that he came out of his cabin to secure a chain for a gate that went across his access road. He noticed that the vehicle was still parked facing east. As he secured the chain, he noticed what he described as three shadows coming out of the woods and walked over to the parked truck.
So, with what he's seen, was he able to say if it was Jeff and Karen, who the third person was?
Sadly, he wasn't able to make a positive identification. He said that he saw two of the figures get into the truck, and he saw one get behind the wheel and one sit in the center. He said, at this time, a vehicle approached from the east and its headlights hit the truck. He said that he saw the third person standing on the passenger side of the truck, slouched and leaning behind the truck's windshield.
Pretty much like they were trying to stay out of view.
Exactly. Around the same time, another vehicle approached from the west. The person behind the steering wheel put their foot on the brake, causing the brake light to, you know, flash. The eastbound vehicle honked its horn. Once both of the vehicles passed, the third person got into the truck, which then drove east on Route 61, at what Louder described as a leisurely pace. Around 90 minutes later, and just 2 miles to the east, 20-year-old Timothy Vaughn and his girlfriend were driving westbound on Route 61. He was coming out of a left-hand turn, and he noticed a fire ahead along a gravel half-moon-shaped turnoff on the southern side of the road. Knowing the location as the site of a county-owned dumpster, he pulled over to investigate the flames. As his car stopped, he noticed that the flames were coming from the cab of the pickup truck. It was parked at an angle and a few feet off the road. Its tailgate and the passenger side door was open. He approached the burning truck and saw the sight that he never expected.
Hey y'all, I'm Dan, and I host a podcast called Kinfolk, Stories of Community and Connection. I talk with folks from all over Appalachia, artists, small business owners, local legends, you name it. We share real stories about what brings us together, what keeps us going, and all the magic tucked away in these hills. If you're into small town charm, big hearts, and good conversation, come hang out with me on Kinfolk. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
In the bed of the truck, he saw the body of Jeff Scott. His head, arms, and upper trunk had been burned. His arms were bent in a manner which brought his hands up to his forehead, kind of like the defensive boxer stance. Yeah. With the truck still on fire, Timothy ran back to his truck, told his girlfriend to stay at the scene, and drove westbound to the home of a friend that was only a half mile away.
He left his girlfriend there.
Yeah.
I would have been like, hey, boo-boo, I'm not being left. I'm coming with.
Right? Like,
oh my God. But then I remember, okay, this was the late 70s and it's not at all like it is today.
No, like it's not like uncommon, but like.
But still, I mean, I don't know. Like some of this stuff blows my mind.
Yeah, I'm like, dude, there was a dead body. Don't leave her there.
Right?
When Timothy got there, he told his friend Jamie French what he had seen. Jamie then drove to the scene of the fire while Timothy called the Giles County Sheriff's Department. Around the same time, another westbound driver, Alan Swote, saw the fire and stopped to be of assistance. Not too long after this, Timothy returned to the scene. Along with Alan, they pulled the body of Jeff from the truck's bed to a safe place about 21 feet away. Not too long after this, police, fire, and emergency vehicles began to arrive and the fire was extinguished. Virginia State Trooper F.M. Blevins was one of the first to the scene at 12:20 a.m.
At this given point, we are now the following day, which is now May 29th.
Yeah. So, in the confusion, little attention was paid to anything else but the fire. Once the flames were put out, a pair of women's shoes were found sitting on the truck's tailgate. Timothy said that he experienced an off feeling.
What exactly do you mean?
Well, he said when he first arrived at the scene, he had a feeling which turned his attention towards Wolf Creek, which was about 50 feet away to the south. So Trooper Blevins carefully made his way through the brush and towards a sandy bar along the creek. That's when he came upon the body of Karen Noble lying face down at the water's edge. She had been shot twice in the head. Realizing now that he had a crime scene on his hands, Trooper Blevins sealed off the area and made an effort to preserve the scene. And Core, I actually have his report in the document. Do you care to read it?
Sure. Quote, on 5/28/78 at 12:01 a.m., I received a call that a vehicle was on fire at State Route 61, just west of the Blaine County line. I arrived at the scene at 12:15 a.m. and observed a 1977 blue Datsun pickup truck on the south shoulder portion of the road. The pickup was on fire. I observed the body of Jeffrey Scott lying to the rear of the pickup. The head and shoulder portion of his body were blackened from the fire. At 12:20 a.m., I contacted the state police, Withful, and advised him to call my duty sergeant. I also requested the Division of Investigations to be assigned to the case. I searched the area until arrival of Investigator Metro. I requested this case be handled by the Division of Investigation, end quote.
By this time, numerous emergency vehicles and people driving by had already crisscrossed a lot of the area around Jeff's truck. Blevins called the Virginia State Police in Withfield and requested assistance from the Division of Investigation, like Court said in the report. Investigator A.K. Metro and medical examiner Caesar Callalung were dispatched. Callalung described both Jeff and Karen dead at the scene. State Police Investigator C.G. Wyatt later arrived and took charge of the crime scene investigation. Timothy and Alan, each who had been driving westbound on Route 61, advised that neither had passed or been passed by any other vehicles since they left Narrows. Authorities gathered that Jeff's truck had been parked where it was found and not forced off the roadway at a high rate of speed. The fuel door on the passenger side of the vehicle was open and the cap was missing. Three small bullet holes were found on the same side, showing what looked like an amateurist attempt to start a fire with the trunk's fuel tank. One thing I want to say is that the upper third of Jeff's body was badly charred, and the bed of the truck was not burned, and the fire had been confined to the truck's cab. Now, Court, I did find the autopsy report. Do you care to read it?
The body is that of a well-developed, well-nourished white male. The head shows third and fourth degree burning and charring with partial obliterations of facial features. There is a gunshot wound of entry in the left temporal region, which will be separately described. The indention is natural and in good repair. There is dried blood present on the forearms and hands. The skin of the right hand shows third and fourth degree burning and charring. There is second and third degree burning involved the upper right chest, left upper chest, and upper arm, right flank, back, and upper inguinal area. The skin of the chest had been spared, as had the skin of the lower extremities. The body is clothed in a pair of blue jeans, which shows slight burning of the waistband. The lower legs are intact, and the most prominent area of the burning is confined to the head and face. The area of burning on the upper chest and forearms had the appearance of a flash-type burn. Personal effect with the body consists of a Timex calendar wristwatch. The watch has stopped at 11:02. The date in the calendar window reads Monday the 28th. There is a small amount of blood present on the case and on the watch band. The crystal is missing. The watch is turned over to Investigator Metro of the Virginia State Police. The blue jeans are submitted to the Forensic Science Laboratory to be tested for accelerants. The pathological diagnosis: number one, gunshot wound of the head and brain. Number two, second, third, and fourth degree of burning and charring involving face, upper chest, back, and right flank, right hands, upper arms, and bilaterally.
To authorities, this made them believe that Jeff had been killed somewhere else than placed within the truck's bed. He was shot once in the left side of his head by a .22 caliber long or short firearm. His official cause of death was listed as gunshot wounds. The defensive position of his arms made it difficult to tell if he had been set on fire before or after he was shot. Karen Noble had been shot twice in the head by a .22 caliber weapon, which each bullet wound was superficial.
So they weren't fatal?
No, and no other defensive wounds or otherwise was found anywhere. Her autopsy showed that both water and sand got in her lungs, which indicated drowning as a likely cause of her death. Karen was found still dressed in her green floral pattern blouse and multicolored floral skirt. It was later determined that intercourse had occurred not long before her death. I do want to say that it didn't appear that it was rape or an assault, so that didn't take place.
So, do we think the couple had been out parking at the picnic table?
I mean, that's what I think it was. And I think someone just, you know, walked up on them, was either watching them or thought, you know, hey, this is my turn to join. And it just went south from there. But back to Karen. Large amounts of sand and mud, a cockle burr in her hair, and shallow grooves along the ground indicated that Karen's body had been removed from the truck and dragged to the location where it was found. The medical examiner determined that Karen was likely unconscious when she entered the water. There were no powder burns or residue found around any of the bullet wounds, indicating that the shots may have been fired from as far as 3 feet or more. The clothing worn by each of the victims was tested, but sadly showed no signs of having come in contact with petroleum substance.
I've already got so many questions.
Right.
My mind is going nuts right now, like nuts. The bodies of Karen and Jeff appeared to speak volumes about their death. Like you said, Jeff had a watch on and so did Karen. Jeff stopped at 11:02 p.m. and the hands on Karen's watch stopped at 11:25 p.m. A .22 caliber slug was removed from each of their skulls. Sadly, both were too mutilated and deformed to permit a full ballistics examination. Three additional .22 caliber slugs or fragments were found at the scene. The presence of six spent rounds and the absence of any shell cases or holes led authorities to think that the weapon used was likely a revolver of some kind.
Despite a search of both ground and air, no firearm was found near the scene of the crime. Jeff's wallet containing his driver's license was missing, along with the gas cap of his truck.
See, this is stuff that makes no sense to me.
Right.
Like, none.
Yeah.
But I have to ask, were they ever found?
No. So, like, it made me wonder if they could have been thrown into Wolf Creek or if they were kind of kept as a trophy for the murders. And, I mean, other evidence shown that the kill may have taken something from Karen. Blood was found in a few places around the crime scene. Type O was found on the truck's bumper. Type A was found on the tailgate, and Type B was found on Jeff's belt.
Now this is getting super weird.
Mm-hmm.
Was it ever said what Karen and Jeff's blood type were?
Karen was Type A Rh positive, and Jeff was Type AB Rh positive.
So who was Type O?
It's never been determined. My only guess is that it could be the killer's blood. The evidence at the scene indicated that both Jeff and Karen were killed somewhere else and then later taken to the locations where they were found. Based upon the progress of the fire in Jeff's truck, officers think that the killer may have been present at the scene like 5 minutes before Timothy and his girlfriend showed up.
And he just left her there.
Right, like, it got me thinking, like, what if the murderer stayed back and was like watching, and he could have been like, oh, well, she was here left alone. Let me just kill her because she is a witness to the scene of this crime. Like, do not leave your boyfriend, girlfriend, friend, cousin, whoever, alone at a crime scene.
I mean, it's... When I tell you my mind is reeling right now, like, my mind is reeling. I've got 1,000 different questions going through my head. One of my biggest questions I have right now is they are saying she's unconscious at the crime scene, but they put it down as drowning. But if she was already unconscious before, and like they said she was, then how did they rule her death a drowning?
Because her face and head were in the water.
But still.
Yeah. So
I don't see how that right there, and especially if they see the drag marks and everything else, you should have known getting well that she was already out of it when she was placed in the water.
Yeah. So I think she was unconscious when she was, you know, dragged out there. Maybe the killer held her head under the water.
I've got like a thousand different questions.
I didn't think about that until now.
Like, and especially like how like sand and stuff moves and everything. Like, did they possibly put sand down her mouth and then held her under to get it down in there to make it look like that?
She could have also been screaming.
Absolutely. Yeah, so. I mean, just 1,000 different questions. But one big lesson, folks, Mark has already said it. We will say it again. You don't leave anyone at the scene of a crime. If we've learned a lot of things, a killer will typically come back to the scene of a crime to gather a trophy or something if they have not already gathered one.
I feel like that's our first life rule. Don't leave anyone at the scene of a crime.
It really is. We don't leave people at the scene of a crime.
So Jeff's truck was found pointed north and a little to the east, slightly at a downward angle. Authorities later said that the truck did not appear to have crashed or forced off the roadway, but was parked where it was found. Investigators remained at the scene past sunrise. In addition to Virginia and Giles County, authorities from Bluefield, West Virginia, as well as West Virginia State Police, joined the investigation. Initially, the investigation focused on friends and family of the victims, most who lived in Bluefield or the surrounding areas. Authorities refused to elaborate whether those that were being questioned were suspects or potential witnesses. So, Court, I have to take a second to talk about one of the rumors.
Okay.
So, rumors about the double murder spread like wildfire through Bluefield. I mean, at one point early in the investigation, an old friend of Karen's was reportedly mentioned as a possible suspect. When word got to this old friend, they attempted to take their own life. Not long after the investigation was revealed that the person in question had actually been in Withfield, Virginia before the time of the murder. The person in question was later eliminated as a suspect. The early flourish of information, which made its way into the press, alarmed Giles County Sheriff John Hopkins, who actually found himself fending off all these rumors. Some reports speculated that Jeff's truck was forced off the road. Another is that another vehicle had been at the scene of the crime prior to Timothy's arrival. Sheriff Hopkins said, quote, "We can't release all the details, or we might as well lay our entire case on the table," end quote.
I mean, he's not wrong.
He really isn't.
And we know how quick rumors get started.
Oh, 100%.
About any type of case, anything of that nature.
Yeah.
Did they ever say if this was a male or a female?
They didn't. But not yet. So, the first major break in the investigation came when Giles County authorities were contacted by Robert Louder.
The guy who saw them go into the woods.
Yes, that's the one. As it turned out, he had another visitor that night. One who left more of an impression.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
He told investigators that he was outside of his cabin along Route 61 between 7 and 7:30 p.m. when an unidentified white male approached his cabin on foot. Him and the visitor talked for about the next hour. The mysterious man told him that he lived in nearby Rocky Gap, Virginia, and that he was on his way home. He said that he noticed that the man's left leg was stiff and that his arm was bent. The visitor said that he had been injured by a smoke bomb while in the armed services, and that he spent the last 9 months or so in a VA hospital. He added that he did not get along with most people because they would usually laugh at him.
Because of his disability.
Yeah, and one thing that stood out to me is that Mr. Louder became nervous when the man said he was something of a people watcher.
Excuse me?
I guess homeboy loved to just sit around and watch people. I mean, it would make perfect sense.
It really would. I mean, I'm sure he people watched for a different reason than what we people watch for.
Oh, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
But he didn't just stop at that. He said that he would often sit on the open hillside across from Louder's property and observe the people who would stop at the picnic table.
Okay, Voyager.
So just off the eastern edge of the property line, while he was talking, the man smoked an unknown number of unfiltered Camel brand cigarettes, later discarding them in the same general area. The man did mention a local family named Hamilton, who he stated were responsible for the vehicular death of his wife and father. Although he didn't refer to himself, the man did mention the name Mulkey and said something about pine seeding and stolen fishing reels. Around this time, Louder said that he started to grow gradually more and more nervous about this random man that just showed up, and he was afraid to anger him, fearing that the result may be dangerous.
The man eventually said that he had better leave as he had a 2-mile walk ahead of him. Mr. Louder actually offered to get the man a ride home, but his offer was declined. He said that he kept a close eye on the man as he walked away to the west and did not avert his gaze until the man was out of sight. He provided authorities with a detailed physical description of this unknown man. Using an identikit, some composites and hand-drawn sketches of the man were created. He was thought to have been in his mid-30s, was 5 feet 7 inches tall, weighing between 150 and 160 pounds, and had light brown or blonde hair, which was short and neatly combed. He was wearing a brown long sleeve corduroy shirt, green or a light blue twill work pants, and a brogan type shoe. He also carried a long, well used walking stick, and Louder noticed a pint of vodka in his back pocket.
Louder said that he had never seen the man before. Cigarette butts dropped by this unknown man were recovered and later tested.
How far from the cabin to the area was Karen and Jeff found?
You're going to hate this. It was 2 miles to the east. This location was also the site of a Giles County-owned dumpster. So at the time, the area where the truck was found was kind of a popular place for teenagers to go because of the sandy bar next to the river. At the time, there really, you know, wasn't too many houses there.
Completely random, but you know how my mind is.
Uh-huh.
Did they question anybody else about this man?
They did, and they asked Louder's nearest neighbor, and she said that she did see the man walking westbound on Route 61 at 8:30 p.m., which, you know, lines up. She also said that she was concerned about the presence and said that she was relieved when the man walked away. She also said that her daughter arrived home about 30 minutes later, driving from Rocky Gap, and her daughter said that she didn't see any man walking. Now, even though they couldn't say publicly who the man was, authorities did have an idea on who it might be. Reports came in that indicated an unoccupied farmhouse about a half mile from the Louder cabin had been occupied by an unidentified male. Authorities searched the farmhouse in question and discovered an additional pile of Camel cigarette butts. The cigarettes had been smoked to the same length as those recovered from Louder's cabin. They thought, well, maybe this guy had been hiding out on the hillside. So a state police helicopter, along with tracking dogs, were dispatched. Several days were spent searching, which turned up no trace of the man. By June 14th, authorities had to publicly state that they were stumped. It was later learned that they did have a person of interest in mind, but didn't have enough evidence to justify naming the man. And authorities continued without any justice for the next 10 months.
On March 31st, 1979, the region was shaken again by another senseless act of violence that day. In a scenario eerily similar to that of the murders of Karen and Jeff, 21-year-old Samuel Davis Smith and his 15-year-old girlfriend pulled into the parking lot of the John's Motel and restaurant in Tazewell, Virginia. They found the restaurant to be too crowded, so they just returned to the car, where they were kidnapped at gunpoint by a white male that neither of them knew. Samuel was forced to drive his 1971 Buick east on U.S. Route 460 and then east again on Route 61. Not too long after being kidnapped, the kidnapper tried to rape Samuel's 15-year-old girlfriend. So Samuel did a smart thing. He crashed his vehicle into a nearby gas station.
I mean, kind of smart. I mean, he could have caused an explosion, but I mean, it was kind of smart.
Yeah. The kidnapper shot at Samuel with a .22 caliber revolver, striking him in the head. The wound, however, was superficial, and then a struggle ensued. Samuel eventually overpowered the kidnapper and got possession of the revolver. The kidnapper, or would-be rapist, immediately fled on foot. Samuel and his girlfriend were later treated at the local hospital and then released. The weapon taken from the kidnapper was a cheap six-shot .22 caliber double-action revolver. Again, authorities felt like they knew who did it. However, they would only publicly describe him as a fugitive from the Giles County Jail, where he was serving a sentence for rape. Authorities soon made the man's name public and also revealed that he was a suspect in the murder of Karen and Jeff.
It was 32-year-old George Byrd from Blaine County, Virginia. This man spent his life in and out of jail, which he escaped from jail and was out during the time of Karen and Jeff's murder. The home where his mother and brother lived was located on Route 61 between the Louder property and the area where Karen and Jeff were found.
Did they think it was him?
Honestly, they were split.
Why's that?
Well, it was noted that the attack on Karen didn't fit Byrd's previous attacks. Unlike Karen, she wasn't beaten or raped. On the other hand, several other aspects did match his recent crime. The caliber of weapon were the same. He took possession of the driver's license. Both involved a drive along Route 61. And in each case, the man believed to be Byrd stated that he hated everyone. Samuel and his girlfriend were later shown a photograph of George Byrd and identified him as a kidnapper. Feeling confident that George was hiding around where his mother lived, there was an extensive surveillance operation set up, hoping to catch him in the open. They established a viewpoint on top of a hill across from the house in question. After a while, Virginia authorities caught a break on the morning of August 19th, 1979. Authorities at the viewing post observed Byrd entering his mother's home.
35 or more officers descended on the home and surrounded it. Despite furious efforts by his mother and brother to prevent their entrance, authorities eventually made their way inside the house and soon found George hidden beneath some insulation in an attic. Ooh, he had to be all itchy and stuff. That's gross.
It really is.
With a barrel of a .30-30 rifle tucked beneath his chin. 2 hours of negotiations ensued. Authorities eventually talked George down by threatening the use of tear gas. He was taken into custody and transported to the maximum security section of the Giles County Jail, the same section from which he had escaped in 1977.
On May 21, 1980, George Byrd was convicted of the original charges brought against him in 1976 and sentenced to life plus 120 years. George Byrd would never serve a single day of his sentence.
So why is this?
That night, he took his own life by hanging himself with a sheet in his jail cell.
I get so frustrated at stuff like this. Like, I mean, it's one of those things, you're really upset. Like, you want to see justice be served.
Yeah.
You want to see these people serve their sentences, things of that nature. But at the same time, you're relieved that this person isn't on the streets anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I know how bad forensics were back in the day. And I just wonder about the forensics and things of that nature. Did they actually have the right person?
Yeah. See, I don't know. I would love to know if they ever like found a sample of his blood anywhere, like if it was tested anywhere or
exactly. I mean, yeah. Like it just things back then, I don't think are the way that they should be done now.
No, oh God, no.
And we are very blessed to have the advancements in forensics that we do,
mm-hmm.
and things of that nature. But as we have learned previously, there is no such thing as an eyewitness. Mm-hmm. Like, you remember what you think. You remember what you want to remember and things of that nature. And that's the reason why there have been literally so many innocent people put into jail and things of that nature because yeah. of, you know, and now they're able to go back and do forensic testing and find out that these folks are innocent. And I'm not saying this guy's innocent by any means. But it just makes you wonder.
Yeah. So with his death, interest in the double murder quickly faded from the headlines, as well as many local memories. Jeff Scott's father, former Bramwell mayor Glenn Scott, passed away in 1996. Karen Noble's parents, William and Elizabeth, passed away within 3 months of each other in 2007. 30 years would pass before their murders were brought back into the public light, thanks to the one and only Timothy Vaughn.
And this is the Timothy Vaughn that discovered the truck on fire, right?
Yes. He began his own career in law enforcement around 1988. He began to quietly review the case of Karen and Jeff.
Good for him.
In 2011, the Bluefield Daily Telegraph posted an extensive essay titled The Age of Innocence Lost on the case of Jeff and Karen. It was a detailed account of both the murders and the search for the prime suspect, George Byrd. 48 years later, the murders of Karen Noble and Jeff Scott remain unsolved.
To this day, it is still being debated if George Byrd was their killer or not.
Jeff Scott and Karen Noble were both laid to rest on May 31st, 1978. Karen in Princeton, West Virginia, and Jeff in Bluewell, West Virginia.
If you have any information on the case of Karen Noble and Jeff Scott, please contact the Virginia State Police Withfield Detachment at 276-223-4206.
We'll be back next week with a brand new case. If you find yourself enjoying Mountain State Mysteries, take a second to follow, download, and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. It helps others find a good West Virginia true crime podcast.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube, all at Mountain State Mysteries.
Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com.
For the show notes, check out our website, MountainStateMysteriesPodcast.com.